Thank you, Peter, and good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Really appreciate the opportunity to be with you this afternoon and to talk about the evolution of a company in the real economy. And I don't know how you feel about this, but I'm not going to say much about the financial crisis unless asked, and you might regard that as a blessed respite for a period of time. I should also acknowledge, by the way, some familiar faces in the room, some of my current and former colleagues who are a part of the story that I'm about to tell. And the good news for you is that they will keep me on the straight and narrow. If I tell any lies, obviously they'll have a point of view about that. But they're all part of this story. And what I wanted to share with you is a story about the evolution of an Australian-based multinational. It's now a global leader in its field, and how we came to be in this position. And at the same time, in telling the Orica story, and particularly to this type of an audience, I wanted to highlight the way in which the opening of the Australian economy led initially to great challenge, and it's fair to say some distress in the company, but ultimately, in my belief, really provided the impetus for us to find a formula that really was successful on the world stage, and therefore, in a sense, helped to create more success and opportunity than would otherwise have been realised in our company. So this is the story of how an Australian-based, market-leading international company, Orica, emerged from the dismantling of Australia's highly protected manufacturing sector. A little bit about Orica for those who don't know us well. We are, as Peter said, based here in Melbourne. We're the world's leading explosives company. The company supplies explosives to the mining and infrastructure sectors in more than 100 countries around the world. We specialise in handling those otherwise dangerous products very safely and efficiently. And in the process, we provide high-quality advice and support that enables our customers to optimise their use of energy and thereby maximise their productivity. In many cases, we have people permanently on the customer's site. That is to say, we're putting the explosives down the drill hole. We're helping design the blast. We have a global market share nearing 30%, although our presence in three great mining regions, Russia, China and Africa, is still small, and so there's still plenty of opportunity for further growth. We think of ourselves as providers of high-service consumables to the mining and infrastructure sectors, and in that spirit, we have moved recently horizontally to supply our customers in other consumables, chemicals and roof bolting products for the underground mining and tunnelling sector. So now we're global leaders in that area as well. Global leaders in explosives, global leaders in strata control products. Actually, many of the world's next generation deposits, mines, are moving underground. And what Minova and Excel, these two recent acquisitions, give us is the opportunity to exploit that trend. And their products are used in sophisticated safety systems, and so a strong trend towards safer mining also helps us in that regard. So the features of those two businesses are twofold. One is we're servicing global resource and infrastructure sector customers. And on the other hand, we're combining science-based consumable products with sophisticated customer-focused know-how to service those sectors. Now, to complete the description of Orica, I must add, of course, that we have other great businesses too. In our chemicals group, we have very strong mining chemicals, water treatment, other specialty chemicals and traded chemicals businesses. As Peter mentioned, taken in total, we're Australia's largest chemicals business. And of course, we have Australia and New Zealand's largest paint and home products business through our ownership of the Dulux, Sellies and Yates businesses. These are great businesses, and recently we announced we're going to be demerging them from Orica because, frankly, they are very different from the rest of our business. But we're very confident that they'll be extremely successful as a standalone entity going forward. So in total, we have about 14,000 employees around the globe. Australia and New Zealand is still a fairly large part of our operations because it reflects the strong mining sector in our part of the world, and it also reflects the strong presence of our chemicals and consumer products businesses in this part of the world. But these days, Australia and New Zealand is less than 50% of the total, and that's a very marked change from our beginnings. In fact, once the demerger of consumer products is complete, we'll be around 90% focused on mining and infrastructure markets. And that's been a very deliberate strategy to focus on these areas of the economy globally, because we think they'll show above average growth in the foreseeable future. The step to demerge consumer products, in fact, is the latest in what has been over the years a radical restructure of the Orica portfolio of businesses. And that started way back in the late 70s, actually, and was accelerated in the late 90s when we became an independent Australian-owned company. So what I want to do now is go back a step or two and to explain how Australian economic policy, in effect, influenced all of this. So a bit of history. Orica's grown out of one of the most illustrious global chemicals giants of the 20th century, ICI, Imperial Chemicals, Chemical Industries. In various guises, ICI Australia can claim to have been established in this part of the world since the 1870s, when its predecessor companies began supplying explosives to the Victorian goldfields. In some ways, we're in the process of coming a full circle back to those roots, but of course that's another story. Over the years, ICI, through its subsidiaries in this part of the world, developed really strong and strongly diversified chemicals businesses, and certainly played an absolutely critical part in the development of Australia. And that over about 70 years, and particularly from the mid-1930s through to the 1970s, ancient history I know, but a very important part of Australia's development, and ICI played a big role there. ICI unquestionably recruited well and brought to us the best scientific and production standards, and therefore played an important part in the economy's development. But as time went on, a changing underlying economic reality asserted itself. In the chemical industries globally, economics were increasingly driven by scale or access to privileged feedstocks. And ultimately, ICI Australia, the businesses we had here, found themselves in subscale, sub-economic positions, and really in a part of a small, relatively closed economy, in those days protected by high tariffs. Tariffs in some cases were as high as 60%. And over time, whilst we'd developed a diverse business and large market shares, as an Australian subsidiary, we had not been allowed by the parent to step outside of this geography, and so we were very constrained to small economies viewed in the global context. Now, I wasn't in the company at the time, but you can imagine the shock that must have reverberated through the business when an unexpected, I think, pretty well across the board tariff cut was announced in the 70s by the Whitlam government. This began a process which continues to this day of opening the Australian economy and reducing trade barriers. And naturally enough, it presented some really immense challenges to a business that was in sub-economic and protection-reliant sectors. It's a little difficult for me to project backwards into the mindset of managers at that time, but I think for a period of about 15 or 20 years, from the late 70s through to about the mid-90s, the company essentially responded defensively. That is to say, whilst we exploited new opportunities when we could find them, there was an enormous focus on benchmarking internationally, on reducing costs and restructuring the businesses that we had. A lot of downsizing had to occur, and that was a fairly continuous process. In a way, this is the tragedy of protection, in my view. I mean, quite apart from the cost to the standard of living in the country that goes with higher cost goods developed by protection. Those protectionist policies are generally only successful temporarily, and ultimately the subsequent cost of adjustment is really high. And our company went through that. We were one of many companies that had to go through those adjustments. Some made it. We were lucky to be amongst those that did make it. The circuit breaker for the company, I think, came in 1997 when ICI, which was the majority owner at that time, pursuing its own restructuring, decided to sell its shareholding in ICI Australia. At that time, we became an independent Australian-listed and Australian-owned company, and shortly thereafter, in 98, we renamed ourselves Orica. So we're cut free from the secure, sometimes frustrating parenthood of ICI, and thrown, I think, a very significant strategic challenge. And that challenge was, in an increasingly open Australian economy, without the benefit of a large international parent, which of our businesses were we going to be able to sustain against the world's best players in those sectors? And which businesses did we have to exit? Where was our growth going to come from? And more as a subsidiary question, how could we reduce the volatility of our earnings? So we had to contemplate questions like, did we have long-term or sustainable or privileged assets? Did we have or could we develop the necessary scale? Could we sustain the technology and know-how necessary to be successful in the longer term in some of these businesses? What volatility of earnings could we accept? Which sectors were likely to grow and have increasing profit pools over time? And once all of that was thought through, how should we manage the transition from where we were at that time to the desired end state? So we chose a number of business platforms to retain at the time, and some of those, incidentally, we've since decided to exit. But explosives was an obvious first choice for a number of reasons. Firstly, we had a relatively strong position in the sector. There was no obvious competitor across the globe that had a stronger position to us, and we had the opportunity re-establish, in a sense, an international business by buying back from ICI its explosives business. Now, secondly, explosives answered the growth question by giving us international scope and in a reasonably strongly growing sector. So there were plenty of opportunities at that time for further expansion internationally. And thirdly, explosives promised to reduce the volatility of our earnings. That's because it was then and is still really dependent on the volume of mining and not so much exposed to movements in commodity prices, as were many of our other businesses at that time. You know, I don't think we recognised it at the time, but we were part of an internationally competitive cluster of connected industries which had been spawned by Australia's most competitive sector, the resources sector. In a way, we might have been, or may be, part of a textbook case of what Professor Michael Porter describes in his work on establishing the competitive advantage of nations. In any case, what's certain is that our linkages to Australia's most internationally competitive industries and companies in the resources sector, it had nurtured our explosives business and given us a supply and service capability that itself was of international standard, and that stood us in good stead as we moved onto an international stage. So quickly, we became an international market leader, and that gave us the necessary scale. We supplied a product which provided the cheapest form of energy to the mining process, and we had the best safety, handling and security systems. We had the ability to innovate and, again, the scale to sustain and enhance the R&D effort that was necessary. Through deep understanding of the material science of our product and of the unique conditions at each mine site, our solutions had the ability and have the ability to lower customers' costs and improve their productivity. So that gave us a confidence to grow that business and use that as the cornerstone of the reshaping of the Orica portfolio. I should acknowledge, though, that the transition of the company over the past decade or so has not been easy or uneventful. In total, we've bought and sold businesses to a value many times the market capitalisation of the company at the time that we became Orica. And we've made probably plenty of mistakes along the way and certainly learnt a lot along the way. Really, that's the subject of another presentation too. But we've just completed our seventh year of continuous profit growth, and we're confident that we can continue that record in coming years. And why the confidence? Well, because we're at present witness to a remarkable economic event in the global mining boom, driven, of course, by developing countries, particularly China and India, but also others. Of course, there's another remarkable event underway at present as the financial system goes through unprecedented upheaval as it systematically reprices risk right through the system. And this in turn is impacting economic growth, there's no doubt about that. But we're still optimistic about the long-term outlook for future volume growth in the resources and infrastructure sector. So looking past the short term, we remain confident that we're well positioned. So you can sense our enthusiasm at Orica. We've positioned ourselves in a world where demand for our product and expertise, we think, will grow steadily. And it's up to us as to how we take advantage of that strong strategic position. Now, I've talked about portfolio reshaping. I need to add that financial and strategic discipline have also been very important. And Orica's success has come from applying three key strategic rules. First, we seek to achieve leadership positions in each of our chosen businesses. We know from research that leaders earn better returns, they're better able to achieve economies of scale, they spend more on marketing and innovation, and in the cases of our businesses at least, they're better able to service global customers. Secondly, we ensure that our businesses earn the right to grow. That is, they earn the right to further investment. We have strict financial criteria and investment hurdles, and everyone knows that they need to be met before additional investment will be made. And thirdly, we stay close to our core businesses, partly as a result of history, but mostly due to the conscious strategic choices we've made over the past decade. We're now in businesses that show above GDP levels of growth, and they offer plenty of scope to meet our growth expectations going forward and deliver our shareholder returns. So there's no need to take the additional risk of moving far from what we already do. Now, that's not to say we haven't taken some calculated risks along the way, and would not be prepared to do so in the future. M&A generally is risky. And part of the making of this company has been the significant acquisitions that we've made. The original acquisition of the International Explosives business back from ICI in 1998 was the start. The acquisition of part of our major competitor, Dino Nobel, in a complicated transaction beginning in 2005, was a second step. And the building of a global leadership position in strata control through two large acquisitions in 06 and 07 have also been important. And in fact, over the past 10 years, there have been about 40 acquisition and divestment transactions involved in the reconstruction of the company. So success in an international business is not one big idea. It's many things. But principally, it's about building and consolidating leadership around the core of things that you know well and you know you can execute well. So before I conclude, let me make a couple of comments about what I think are the broader implications of the Orica story for policy setting. The first point to make is that our company, despite being initially imperiled by the progressive opening up of the Australian economy, has in the end benefited enormously from that policy. The restructuring we had to go through initially was painful, there's no doubt about that. There were plenty of people who suffered very difficult dislocation as a consequence, but ultimately we found a way to respond and to make the company more than competitive internationally, and I think that's left the company on a much stronger footing than would otherwise have been the case. I think actually we're entering a more challenging period in which to keep the momentum behind the reforms necessary for the continued expansion of free trade. The collapse of the Doha talks in Geneva earlier this year was extremely disappointing in my view, as much for what it said about the difficulty of promoting concerted international action as for the specific opportunity lost. There have been signs in the US for a while of an emerging strain of protectionism. It's been pushed from the headlines for the moment, but it may well be a threat in coming months in an economy under a degree of economic pressure and hopefully emerging from the financial crisis that it's in presently. Free trade may well get caught in a backlash if the globalisation of the financial system gets blamed for some of the fallout of the current crisis. In short, the support for free trade policies may be waning for the moment, and the benefits, though, are as large as ever, and we need to press on and keep telling the positive story about free trade and keep that reform going. You know, over the past couple of decades, Australia has succeeded in producing an internationally competitive economy. It's done so not through paying its people less or cutting living standards, rather it's done it by playing to strengths, especially national resource strengths, and encouraging other firms connected to its most competitive sectors to widen their horizons to compete and to grow. We've maximised the contribution of our natural and human resources, opened the economy to international competition, but also to international opportunities. And it's forced our enterprises to make hard decisions and adopt strategies to maximise competitiveness, and I think in that process encouraged the growth of internationally competitive firms. It's kind of tempting to talk about Orica as an isolated story, but it's not. We're not really alone in being an Australian-based successful international business. I won't mention all their names, but the success of Australian firms in mining, mining services, engineering, education, manufacturing, medical, agricultural sectors is really quite astounding. There's lots and lots of businesses like these growing successfully internationally. And in particular, as I've said before, Orica is part of an internationally competitive cluster of firms which have grown around the Australian mining industry. Recently I saw a list of ASX-listed companies connected to the mining industry, and I was surprised to see that over 70 fitted that definition. So Australia's a good place to be for companies like ours. A strong cohort of internationally competitive customers, suppliers are of a high standard and they complement the standards that we need to achieve. The regulatory regimes are by and large sensible, and in our case, the supply of science-based, motivated young employees is reasonably good. Australia is an enormous beneficiary of free trade, and we must be at the forefront of making the case for continued reform. But now that we act as a global company, from that perspective, it's easy to see how Australia is competing amongst other nations to attract its share of investment and employment. To a large extent, actually, the location of investments we make as a company will be driven by the location of our customers. But there are investments that support the business, either globally or internationally at least, and Australia, in a sense, competes for those investments. To this end, minimising sovereign risk, simplifying and reducing taxation and improving the productivity of our workforce have to be the key objectives. We've got a fairly good record on sovereign risk, and I don't want to go into it in detail, although I note that in the work done recently by the Economist Intelligence Unit, Australia ranked only 11th amongst the least risky nations in which to do business. So without having studied that, there's obviously some room still for improvement. The Henry Review of Taxation is a tremendous opportunity to simplify our taxation system. The interim report found that we have 125 different taxes paid by Australians each year, and many of these are levied on essentially similar types of transactions by different governments across different jurisdictions. And that just can't be efficient. And whilst it's common for business to be arguing, some would say self-interestedly, for lower rates of business taxation, it has to be recognised that we do compete with other low-tax regimes. And a lower rate of business tax will almost certainly, in my view, be beneficial to the economy in the medium term. And productivity improvement. Well, it's a multifaceted and long-term challenge, but it is the key to improving our standard of living. It encompasses policies relating to competition and education, innovation, workforce and participation, immigration and so on. And it's no secret that our productivity improvement has stalled since around 2002. Ironically enough, actually, a lot of it's due to decline in productivity in the mining sector. But if I might make a special plea in this area, it is that we really push home the current efforts inside COAG to improve intergovernmental interfaces in this country that are so critical to the certainty of policy making, to the development of key infrastructure, and to the operation of a relatively efficient and seamless economy. The inefficiency of duplicated and overlapping legislation and the inertia in policy making that results from the lack of cooperation amongst different levels of government in Australia is a real drag on our economic progress. So I wish great success to those who are trying to reform that process. So in many ways, the Orica story is one that's absolutely full of optimism, and in many ways an affirmation of the policies Australian governments have followed over the past 20 or 30 years. But we all know that in a competitive world we can't stand still. Australia's got great advantages in the current global economic context, but we have to keep driving for economic reform and productivity improvement so that our successors can look back in 20 years' time and reflect on the continued improvement in our standard of living, driven by many more success stories like ours. Thank you.